So this is typically how people define rural America. So USDA puts it in a box. It's about 50,000 people. But we all know that sometimes it can look a little bit different. So we talk about distance from a metro area. So again, just looking around Austin or some of the bigger urban centers here in Texas, we know that there's these peripheral communities that get lumped into a metro area, but when you look at them, when you're in them, you don't sit there and think metropolis or city. And there's lots of things that can define it, but one of the things I always like to share with people is my definition of rural. And for me, it is not a geography. I always tell people, rural is a culture. And when you define rural as a culture, it makes it harder to marginalize rural people. So I know Lucille got up and gave you a little bit about my background, and of course the bio is in your book. But what normally doesn't make it into bios is sort of that background context. So I grew up in the Mississippi Black Creek Wilderness. So there is no sort of population that's counted there. The U.S. Forestry Service is supposed to do it, but when asked, they will tell you no one's really counting. So we grew up there. I lived in a two-bedroom, one-bath house. There were three generations that lived in that dwelling. My brother and I split a partially enclosed carport, so that was our bedroom. It is persistent poverty, as we see a lot of rural communities are. We did not have potable water that ran to our home. It had one light bulb in the entire house, and that was in the kitchen. So this is a narrative that a lot of people have in rural America. And today, when we talk about places that are impoverished in the United States, oftentimes people's mind and concept goes to a version in the 80s and 90s when we saw downtown centers really dilapidated, not seeing investment. We saw huge amounts of BIPOC populations pushed into certain corners and regions. But as the United States has evolved and cities have gentrified, what we have seen is that poor people have been pushed further and further to the peripheral. BIPOC populations that have traditionally been in cities are also being pushed to suburban communities and more rural communities. And then today, when we look at the United States at where persistent poverty lives, over 82% of the persistent poverty counties in the United States are rural counties. So I want you to digest that little tidbit for just a second, and then we begin to think through where are the investments, who's doing the work. So 20% of the United States is rural. What percentage of private grant making do you think goes to rural communities? Anybody? Call it a number. What's a guess? An educated guess. 10, 5. Okay. If we're 20% of the population, what should it be? Should it be 20%? Maybe. I always tell people rural's a heavier and harder lift, so I like more than 20%. As of today, USD, only 7% of private grant make. Plurality of it is actually going to institutions of higher learning. Tribal also gets looped in with rural and frontier. What percent of private grant making do you think goes to tribal? Anybody? It's actually right at it. It's a little bit less than 2%. It recently dropped. And when we think about the percentage of the population of the United States that's actually tribal, and we look at the persistent poverty that exists on reservations in the United States, some of those numbers are a little bit scary when we think about that sort of investment. And again, if we were talking about being equitable, we'd be looking at a 20% mark. But what we often see within the philanthropic community is that there is a lack of representation for rural communities on boards that exists within CEOs, program officers. We often see the clustering of philanthropy in major metropolitan areas that also get very place-based, and they just don't necessarily see the inroads to rural communities. So that's one of the ways that we play in this space, is even though we are a community development financial institution, really what Rural LISC has grown to be is an intermediary for public and private funding to rural spaces. So what we do is, I always tell people, you know, Ford Foundation is never going to have an office in Tuttle, North Dakota. Rockefeller Foundation is never going to have an office in Itabena, Mississippi. So what they end up doing is they'll give it to groups like Rural LISC as one grant, and then we work with and through our community partners to actually deploy it across a broad range of program areas. In addition, a lot of philanthropy is very hesitant to invest in rural places, largely because of scale. And that's one thing that we really have to unpack and talk through as part of a community of funders when we are talking about nonprofits and service, is what is scale in rural communities? It's one of the ugliest words that we see and have to fight against. We are never going to have the outputs that you're going to see in San Francisco, New York, or Chicago, but your percentage of impact can actually be a lot greater in rural areas. One of the things that we really discussed at Philanthropy Southwest, for those of you who are trying to make inroads into these communities, is that rural can be a wonderful test kitchen, usually because it takes less dollars for the impact. So when we're looking at rural communities, they make wonderful demonstration sites to create the proof points for you to then go launch a new theory of change, a new logic model in urban. If you can make it work in rural, you can make it work there. So it's one of those conversations that we need to unpack. So for those of you in the room, just a simple showing of hands, how many of you are funders?